The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
The primary results are out. The second count has been updated a little early tonight. We're going to get into that, as well as Inslee swinging his veto power around Wall Ledge. Are we ever going to build more schools? Will we ever have a capital budget? And we are going to honor one of our compatriots, Joe Tehan, whose show ended this week. But first, let's talk about orange skies. There is, according to several sources, no relief in sight from our BC wildfires. I'm sure if you're out anywhere outside, you have probably noticed either a different color or had some difficulty breathing. Our engineer said that he literally saw the haze pouring over Higgins on the way in tonight. Here's what's happening. Thousands have been evacuated across the province of British Columbia. Over 300 buildings, over 60 miles of fencing has burned down across BC. Western Washington is in the moderate category for air quality. Some spots are down into the unhealthy for sensitive groups category in Puget Sound, and even completely unhealthy along the Olympic Peninsula. And here's what's going on. Because of the location of the fires in Upper BC, a lot of the smoke is actually blowing sort of around us, hitting Port Angeles and the peninsula, coming down into Seattle, which was completely covered in haze this morning.
Yeah, it was really dramatic looking at the pictures of the Seattle skyline posted by the local news agencies. You know, they a lot of them did comparisons like, this is what it looked like 3 days ago, and this is what it looks like now. And it really is this disgusting fog appearance over it. It's very sad, and very high accompanying temperatures for those poor folks down in the South Sound for the rest of the week.
Well, it's probably comforting for people who have moved here from Los Angeles, but I think in the Pacific Northwest, we're sort of spoiled, and we are very accustomed to having very clean air that is very frequently washed by rain, and it's discomforting to see that kind of smog and, you know, that kind of pollution in our skies.
Well, I agree with you. And not just L.A., but China, several parts of the world. You're absolutely, it's a good insight. You know, people live with this every day. At the same time, because our skies are so clean, for the most part, I have seen burn bans in Whatcom County ignored every single year. And I hope that this is a really good reminder that we're not messing around. The burn ban went into effect for Whatcom County a few days ago in advance of all of this. And I'm still getting the sense that there's some people burning things around, but things can catch, as we can clearly see. And one of the worst things about this, though, is that at least two of the over 138 fires are now suspected to be arson.
Yeah, and locally, it's not just remote British Columbia, which isn't that remote, obviously, but there are fires burning on Chuckanut Mountain right now too, and you know, that's a huge loss for, you know, our area, for recreation, for beauty, you know, people
for
need
wildlife,
to be
people, animals.
Yeah, this is the time of year where people need to be careful about their behavior, and I just hope that people can look into the sky and have a recognition that they need to be very cautious at this time of year so they don't contribute to, you know, this.
And this is only the beginning for, you know, what could be a very long season for this in our region. You know, there was just a new one today I saw as I was walking over off of exit 88 on I-5 down in southwest Washington. We're probably going to see this for a few months.
Heavens. And I don't know if you remember last year, it was seriously straight out of a creepy sci-fi film. And I've lived here for at least 20 years and never have seen anything that color of orange. We had, again, of course, it's always hot at the same time. We had screens in our windows. We had to take the screens out of our windows and breathe through cloth because, yeah, it the impact. And I think because we're in a valley, boy, we can be bigger targets than we are. Not luckily for everybody. In this case, a little bit luckily for us, it is going towards the Olympic Peninsula. And I wanted to point out that the haze has reached all the way down to Portland. And they have a haze watch. They have a breathing watch. And Portland is in the hundreds. It actually cooled Seattle down a little bit, but Portland's supposed to be 108, 109 this week. So I can't imagine that combination. Just want to remind you that there is an air quality alert for all of Whatcom County, especially if you have a respiratory illness for children and elders. So if you have a breathing allergy or other sensitivities, please take precautions. And let's hope that this is the end of the fires for this summer, if that's at all possible. Okay, let's move on to the big exciting news about the primaries. Who wants to jump in and say what was surprising to them?
I'm not going to say that I was surprised, but I kind of expected Bostrom running citywide in for city council to kind of hit Donald Trump's number, which was 18.5%, and it looks like he's a little shy of that, so it wasn't quite as galvanizing. But overall, I don't think there's anything that's tremendously surprising. Roxanne Murphy, right now with a supermajority of votes, is a bit higher than I expected, but nothing.
Well, let me back up and go through some of the numbers. I won't do a whole list, but just a couple of the key races that we were looking at, particularly District 2, North Bellingham, which is a new district, and Todd Donovan, who is an incumbent in a different district, but still an incumbent, choosing to run in District 2 because his district's going to end and Sat Paul's going to run in it. So that became a race of a pseudo-incumbent versus a very progressive challenger, Amy Glasser, who had basically declared in December pretty early. And she got 27.51 and Todd got 53.46 and the Republican got about 19%. And then in the race that you were just talking about, Bellingham City Council, Roxanne has been bumped up in the second count to almost 67%. And Gene Layton and Eric were sort of always going to be fighting it out for second place and a spot in the general election. And Gene has gone down a little bit. She's around 16%, and Eric is around 18%. So let's stick with that race for a minute, Bellingham City Council. Did you, Tim, think that Roxanne was going to do pretty much what she did?
Well, and I wrote about it this week, but the math is always hard in primaries because in a top two primary, because people that are very similar in their appeal tend to peel votes off of one another. And that's what I expected could happen in District 2 County Council, was that theoretically those two positions could have peel votes off of each other.
But remember, and then, we're going to stick with the city first.
Let me talk about District 2 first, and then I will get to Bellingham City Council. So in that particular race, you know, you kind of expect that those two would peel votes off of one another and somebody else would draft on through and into second place or even into first place in that scenario. And that's kind of what we see, I think, in Bellingham, is that traditional mathematics of two people kind of pulling from one another and then somebody coming in on top of it.
But not the case this time.
Well, let me continue, because what really happened, I think, was that Roxanne got a massive, massive over support. She got like 70%. And some of those votes could have gone to somebody like Gene and helped Gene through, but they didn't. So the votes got concentrated with Roxanne, and what that allowed is for somebody like Eric to come on through. And I guess what I would say is, you know, out of the candidates, I think that in an election, I think Roxanne and Gene Layton would have had the better conversation about issues that are really pertinent to Bellingham, about neighborhoods and neighborhood character and housing affordability. They were very much on those topics, and I think that we would have gotten a much more robust and better conversation going into the fall if that had been the outcome.
Well, I disagree with your premise a little bit in that I don't see Jean Layton being, I mean, again, let's point out that this is a nonpartisan race, supposedly, but I don't see Jean Layton being a Democrat, quote unquote, or being on that side of the left in a lot of issues. Now, there's things she's in favor of, like better internet service, and there's things that she really cares about in terms of what is typically a Democrat issue, but when it comes to housing, when it comes to accessory dwelling units, that there are areas where I wouldn't position her in the same place. So I think in a way, this is an unusual race. It's an unusual race because we don't normally have somebody running on the right who is that extreme, who carries signs around, who is telling people who are living their lives that they're going to hell because they're sinners. So that already makes it an unusual race. But then just even putting him aside, looking at Jean and Roxanne, I don't think that that's the typical left versus the left.
No, I don't think it is either. And I guess, you know, the argument was framed in a different way than I probably would have framed it, because I think what really happened in this particular race is this is a victim of a low turnout primary. I think if there, I mean, it's hard to say that because the turnout in Whatcom County was about 24%, and the average around the state was 18, which is terrible when you think
right.
about it.
That and only the fact that we're higher than everybody.
Yeah,
but,
we're. I
so
mean,
what?
So
yeah.
It's like when we talk about low turnout, Whatcom County actually turned out pretty fantastically. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think if there would have been more mainstream voters coming in on this, I think there would have been a different distribution of those in those three races.
Yeah, and I, you know, when you're running a primary campaign against an incumbent to whom you are ideologically similar, not the same on a lot of things, but similar, you know, you have a lot of challenges. You have to, first of all, convince people to vote at all, because primaries are difficult to get people motivated for. And that's just not just here, that's everywhere across the country. Primaries are tough. And you've got to make a case that, you know, on these areas where I'm different, that's worth voting for me, the person you don't know, versus the person you do know. Even, you know, you may not agree with them on everything, but you know them better. And so I think this was a tough one coming in. I honestly did not expect Roxanne to do quite as well as she did. I kind of thought that Jean had more of a shot than the results kind of indicate, but you know, it's tough. It's a hard position to be in as any kind of candidate.
Yeah, I think that's where it is. I mean, I think that you know, if we're going to break down Eric's, you know, if we look at that as a pie chart, what I think is interesting is, personally, I could be wrong about this, but I think that's all the votes he's going to get. Period. In the general, I think it's going to be a blowout. In the general, I don't think Roxanne has any concern about re-election. But if we're going to look at the pie chart, there are a lot of people who use their ballot to troll, to make statements.
Unpack that a little bit.
Well, to make statements against government or about government, or just to kind of, you know, be flippant about, you know, I'm going to vote for the worst person on the ballot. There's a certain percentage of people. Then, unpacking this a little bit more, there are probably very religious people who saw him as the Christian candidate. And then there are people that probably really agree with his positions on homosexuality. And I mean, you know.
And to be fair, the people who may not agree or progressive Christians and
right.
people who are socially more liberal, the Republican Party of the county did endorse him.
Right.
So people who aren't paying attention, or people are like, well, he's the closest to me. I mean,
that's right.
Look at our recent national election, right?
Right, and that's that last category, you know, of endorsement, and you know, I think that there's a cap on that in Bellingham. I mean, maybe there's 2,000 people total in the city of Bellingham that are really on board with that, and then you've got a community of much larger than that. But when you have a low turnout election, you know, you're going to get this thing kind of almost like the distillate at the bottom of a glass that's evaporated. I mean, you're going to get this concentration of that. I mean, they're motivated voters. Let's put it that way.
And it's almost only the motivated voters
that vote in a primary.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the sort of thing that can have dramatic results. Like when Ted Cruz was running in Texas. He was running against an establishment conservative, and there was a natural disaster. There was like a hurricane that canceled the election, and so the election got moved to like the end of June for the primary, and the only people who showed up were the people who were super motivated, and they were able to push him through the past the establishment. That can happen, but like you were saying, in Bellingham, we've got a lot of Catholics, Muslims, Jews, LGBT, atheists, fornicators, you know, people who are...
I can't believe the people you just put in the same category.
I'm going down the list on his sign from memory. So, you know, there's a lot of people who fall into the specifically targeted. And if this was a different type of conservative, if this was like we see in the county races, the just kind of general conservative, I want there to be more balance. I think that, you know, the current council is hostile to workers and citizens and all of this. I think they would have a much higher ceiling. I think you would have seen a much better performance, but that's not what we got.
Right. And you know, this feeds back into what you were saying earlier, Stephanie, which is let's assume that Bellingham, I mean, let's just take a number out of the air and say that Bellingham is maybe about 70% liberalish thinking. Well, if we look at the race between Amy and Todd, they kind of split that 60% among themselves, right? And the 40% went to the third candidate. And in this race, Roxanne got all of the 60%. And that's really what happened was there wasn't a splitting going on among that sort of progressive. And maybe she wasn't a... Jean wasn't as progressive, perhaps. I spoke to her. I thought she was progressive on a lot of issues. I don't think she was kryptonite in any way. And I think it's, I mean, I would hate to come in third in this particular race, and I feel bad for her.
Well, and I hear you. I think that there's a difference between being more conservative, more moderate, and kryptonite. But I think that those three people have clearly defined those roles for us. And I do hear what you're saying. And I will give a little plug to our website, Cascadia News Now, because we did interview all three of those candidates, and you can hear for yourself whether Jean is more moderate or not. I think what's interesting is that Jean Layton and Amy Glasser, they didn't exactly run together, but they sort of ran a concomitant campaigns that they were helping each other out, and they appeared at events together, and that there's a whole other layer of this, which is the Bernie Hillary layer.
Yep.
And that's where Amy Glasser very clearly comes from, and I think Jean came from it as well, and that puts a whole different light on the establishment Democrats, those who are frustrated with establishment Democrats. What's interesting, though, is that Amy's race with Todd, the numbers are so different than Roxanne's with Jean. So why do you think that there's such a distinction there?
Well, I would say on that one, I think Amy ran an excellent campaign. You know, put it in very simple terms. I think she ran a very excellent campaign. She knocked on thousands of doors. She talked to people. Jean did not actually get out there, but you're right. They both kind of ran their campaigns as, you know, we weren't selected by the Democrats, and that's why you should vote for us, is because, you know, we're not party animals. They both kind of went out on that. But I think that Amy just ran, she ran a sterling and stellar, fabulous campaign. It's going to be very exciting to see what happens going into the fall. Because
for anybody. Let me also say, for somebody who's never run anything before.
Correct.
And not had a political career, she hasn't been people's
Correct.
Campaign manager. She hasn't been part of the party. She hasn't played Correct. Those political games either.
Well, and she's kind of a live wire. So it's, you know, it's been really interesting to watch her be the candidate. And, you know, I did not expect her to do as well as a candidate as she did. But to talk a little bit about she and Layton kind of teaming up, you know, when you have a community like Whatcom County, which is not huge, and we have a lot of endorsing groups that all tend to endorse the same way. We don't have something in our neck of the woods that's kind of like the 36th District Democrats for statewide things that always endorse some oddball. You know, if you are the establishment candidate, you can pretty much count on a whole raft of endorsements. And if you're not going to get those endorsements, and you know it from the outset, it kind of makes sense to team up with the other folks and try and, you know, make a brand of that. And I think that they did that to varying degrees of success. But I think that you know, Amy Glasser did a much better job overall of the candidate role.
Yeah, I think that you're both pointing out something that doesn't get a lot of thought or credence when we look at results in general about elections. I'm gonna out myself as being old, but I remember Tom Harkin when he ran for president, and I freaking loved him, and then his campaign imploded. Like, you see the person, you hear their message. Maybe not so much in Whatcom on a primary, but in general, you start to form an opinion. But you're not seeing the machine or the lack of machine behind the person. And it's not just the, I don't want to say automatic endorsements, but the name recognition and the party does tend to line up on the state level, on the national level, and on the local level behind their incumbents. And that's kind of the party's role to a certain extent, is to keep their known quantities in office. So you don't get to see who, if anybody, is on anybody's staff and what they're doing and how organized they are. And if you're brand new at this, which I've been in that position as a former candidate, it can be a little overwhelming even applying for some of those endorsements. And let's point out, I can't list Jean Layton, when I interviewed her, said she didn't have any endorsements. I don't know if she picked any up. Amy had a bunch, even though she didn't have the Democrats, she didn't have the establishment, but she went out and she got even city council people before Todd had even announced. So that's indicative of her campaign. I think you're totally right, Dave and Tim, about how hard she worked. I'm not in District 2, and didn't get to vote. But I got to tell you, I received mailers from Amy Glasser. I got repeated texts on my phone, even though I'm like, hey, you guys are wasting your energy. But they're like, okay, well, do you know anyone? Do you know anybody who's in her district? And they were really, really determined. In terms of the Roxanne race, the only person who came to my door or left any literature was Eric Bostrom. I'm like, what? I mean, but never saw Jean, never saw Roxanne, to be fair, didn't have to see Roxanne.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think the other thing that's a big factor is, you know, I'm this way, but I don't think 99% of the people that are voting are this way. But people don't vote strategically in primaries. They don't. They vote for who they want to see in office in a primary. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing. Right. When I cast my ballot, I put it in for the people that I thought were second tier so that they would be. Make it through the general. So I'll admit it. I voted for Jean because I wanted to see Jean. I knew Roxanne was number one and was going to be number one. I wanted to see Jean as number two.
And I got to disagree with you. I think that there are the bulk of people. And when I say the bulk of people, I mean the people who vote in the general election who were not here physically or voterly, who are not around. Those people, you're absolutely right. They see somebody, they believe in them, they know them, they vote for them. When it comes to a primary, and we talked about this a little earlier about who's left and who really cares, there is a lot of strategy going on. I saw it on Facebook. When there was a lot of hate Facebook posts directed at Eric Bostrom, there were a lot of people who said, yes, he's really scary, vote for Roxanne, as if she was the only person in the race.
Correct.
And there, and at the Democrat endorsement meeting, it was a wipeout, and the Democrats came together and the Riveters came together, and I believe everything I heard was that their strategy was he's going to be the easy one to beat. Jean Layton provides somewhat of a challenge, so let's shut her down. So I think the strategic voting was pretty clear in the results.
Well, I think, I agree with that as far as the parties are going. I was talking about individual voters.
Sure.
I mean, the parties did that. I mean, you know, as an example, Todd sent out a mailer that put him in juxtaposition with Daniel Colick because that was, and a lot of people criticized that. I thought, you know, it's like this is a good political strategy. I mean, we won't have to agree with it, but it's actually a good strategy to make a prediction that he's going to be the guy going forward and to set your mark that he's going to be the person you're going against. That's not going to be the way it is. We're all the better for it, I think. We're going to have a really excellent election in District 2. But I don't fault people for coming up with a political strategy and moving forward on it. Now, parties, that's what they do is strategize. I was just talking about individual voters They vote for the people they want to see in office.
Right. And again, it's the people in the parties who made the difference, I think, in
Correct.
This primary. But we just have a couple minutes left in this half hour, and I want to give a really strong shout out to Rebecca Boonstra. Now, this is not an endorsement. I'm not in District 3, but this is also a new district, as they all are in the county. It was typed from the beginning as being an out in the county district. Sat Paul was going to run in it, and he decided not to. Sat Paul Sidhu, who's our current county councilman. And I think at least the talk I heard back when the commission was drawing this was it was a throwaway for conservatives. And the other two candidates, Tyler Byrd, Cliff Langley, Cliff's kind of like, oh my God, America, keep it free from government. And Tyler Byrd's like he's the pretty Vincent Bias boy who's got all the small mayors. And here came Rebecca Boonstra, and she is in the lead with 38% of the vote. I know that's an even split, but it blows me away that she is in the lead at this point and that she did so well in a district that progressives kind of threw away.
See, I completely disagree with you, because I think that is the race that kind of proves the general theory about what happens, where the two people that were on the conservative side took votes away from each other, and she raced right between
Sure.
the two, and she was the top vote getter because there was a conflict between which
Sure.
conservative we should. So I see that as a congratulations, Rebecca. I'm not saying that, but I see it as a very typical outcome in what happens in top two primaries. I think another win for Whatcom County, because I think that conservatives selected the more charming and effervescent electable person in that race. And it's going to be a very interesting race. But and I want to give it over to Dave, because Dave has spoken effusively about District 3 and what a fun district it is. And I agree with him. Who knows what's going to happen in District 3?
Well, let me just say, I do think that you're right, that there's a possibility that they split. And yet, when it comes back to the hard work and the organization, that she gets some strong credit for that.
Absolutely. But this is a very low turnout result. We're going to have to wait till we get the abstracts to actually see how it went by precinct-wise. But it's going to be really difficult for Boonstra to get people motivated, get people out, and make sure that this isn't her ceiling, because that's entirely possible. This is a bizarre district with really limited media and really widely distributed, with no real population centers. So
yes,
it's going to take a lot of work to
yeah.
win this.
And, we talk about ground game, and the ground game of Democrats is they get out and knock on doors. This is a very, very, very difficult district to
yeah.
knock on doors in.
Yeah.
And Dave, I think you're right. I mean, the typical way of viewing this is you would stack all the conservative votes on top of one another and say that everybody that did not vote for Cliff Langley or did vote for Cliff Langley are going to vote for Tyler Byrd, and that's what we're looking at going into a general election. It's a fascinating district, and I was speaking to somebody that's a campaign strategist, and they said, who knows, how do you actually campaign in District 3 with the limitations that there is no population center there?
Well, one of the things that I think recommends her is that she does not have the typical Democrat chops, and that she's very involved in the Chamber of Commerce out there. Yes, she's involved in Opportunity Council, but she's been involved with people on a local level. And I think now I'm speaking as somebody who doesn't live out in Maple Falls or Kendall, so I don't know. I'm speaking out the side of my neck. But I believe that she has a sincerity, kind of a Patty Murray sincerity, where she could connect with people where a lot of poster children of Democrats couldn't. So you are listening to Cascadia News Now, a very lively episode. I'm Stephanie Contouris with Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. You are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham and KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt. Before we leave the primary stuff, I think in your gristle today, Tim, you talked about how the issues are going to come up for the general, and you talked a lot about the Lake Whatcom Joint Policy Group. We've been off the air for a couple of weeks. I wanted to give you a chance to bring that up and talk about why you think it's crucial.
Well, I see it as a symbolic of something of a conversation that's going on around the state, and particularly in local government, which is how do you fund things in a state that allows only an income tax, I mean, I'm sorry, not an income tax, but only a property tax, only a sales tax, and in a environment in which, you know, one of the political parties is essentially no tax ever at any time for any purpose whatsoever. And Lake Whatcom is an interesting case model because in trying to meet the Department of Ecology standards for Lake Whatcom to try to improve the water quality of Lake Whatcom, the county has spent a lot of money, and it's basically exhausted its reserve fund for Lake Whatcom. It's going to basically run out of money, and at the reserve anyway, not completely, but the reserve for Lake Whatcom in 2018. And so the question is, like, you know, do we live with that, or do we try to make a case that maybe Whatcom County, which hasn't had a tax increase in 25 years, maybe needs to raise taxes? And when I say it hasn't had a property tax increase, they haven't even taken the bank capacity that they're entitled to take, which is 1% each year. Whatcom County has not taken that for 20 years.
Now, so, does that have to be an initiative, or is that an automatic?
No, the state of Washington allows local governments to take a 1% increase in order to stay pace with inflation. That does not keep pace with population increases or the demands on a water system or any of that kind of stuff. It says, well, basically inflation, but they haven't even taken the inflation.
Yeah, it's less than the inflation rate.
Correct. So there, Whatcom County is in a desperate financial predicament. You know, the courthouse is failing, the jail issue, we could talk about
the jail. And
the
courthouse will cost millions of dollars.
There's
right?
capital improvements, massive capital improvements, and the reason that the county has not raised taxes is because they've kicked a lot of that down the road. But you can only kick that down the road so long. And so, at least on Todd Donovan's, one of the things he wanted to do in the campaign was, it's a political environment. We can talk about political things. We haven't even talked about the Port of Bellingham right. and how they can politicize particular things, but. So it's a political environment. We can talk about hard things if we want to. And I think Amy's up for that, too. I think she's certainly not hostile to any of that. I think they'll have a robust conversation. But this is a conversation that the county needs to hear because if you don't do something about revenue, you're going to see a level of service drop. And that's a complicated thing, but one way I can present it as a level of service is, if the level of service goes down on, like, fire departments, then when you're having a heart attack and you call the fire department, instead of 5 minutes, it's 25 minutes for an ambulance to show up. That's what a level of service drop means. It means that they just it's simply there's not, it hasn't kept pace with population. And so what you can expect from your public services is going to go down.
Yeah, I'm very excited by the fact that Todd Donovan ran explicitly on, among other things, rethinking the way we collect taxes in this county, and wound up with more than 50% of, again, a low turnout primary, but did well in a primary in something that the county council has been afraid to touch for a long time.
Yeah.
And I really hope that's a signal that there is enough demand for service that we can actually have this conversation.
Right. And the fun thing is, with the redistricting, you could not have had this conversation before, because with the three districts, you always had some weird outlying area that you had to appeal to, right? Now it's like Bellingham only.
It's kind of like the congressional district with Rick Larson.
Right. So Todd can he can make an appeal to Bellingham voters.
And Amy too, to be fair.
And Amy too. I'm not saying that, but I'm just talking about the taxation issue. Yeah. You have a bully pulpit to make an appeal to a group of people who are not going to, like, you know, get out the torches and pitchforks if you're making that particular appeal. So one of the interesting and fun things about the redistricting is, we haven't seen it yet in what's going to happen in Linden, but suddenly you're free from trying to be
all things to all people.
And yeah. So in Linden, in a few years, you're going to see people that farming and agriculture, that's their only thing. That's the only thing they care about. They're going to move forward. In this particular race, we can talk about the candidates, both Amy and Todd, can talk about things that are very hard for the county to listen to, but are not hard at all for Bellingham to listen to.
So I'm climbing through this Lake Whatcom Joint Policy Group, trying to keep up with you. And And I'd like to just ask you a couple questions about it. But sticking with the general election, is this going to be an issue that is of appeal to enough voters other than the environmentalists, other than the people who have been kind of focusing on water issues?
Well, the interesting thing about District 2 is it's the one Bellingham district that actually fronts on Lake Whatcom. And so that particular council person is the representative for Bellingham's drinking water supply. So whether you're, you know, an environmentalist or a tree hugger or whatever, you still drink water and you use water. And so the quality of Lake Whatcom is important. Todd's message is he's going to use the very near-term emergency of what's going on with Lake Whatcom to make the larger case that the county has got structural revenue problems that need to be addressed.
Yeah, and these are things that benefit all of us. You know, none of us are better off because other people are going without services that they need. You know, we don't gain anything as a society from that. I think that rethinking how we do this is really something that is going to really improve the life of all of Whatcom County.
Well, the discussions will hopefully be fascinating, and because it's the general election, I know that there is at least one, if not several, debates that will be happening on media and in person, and we will be tracking that for sure, and we will get more into the Lake Whatcom issues on a longer episode. But because we don't have tons of time, let's touch in with state. When we last left off, we had a budget, but we did not have a capital budget. The capital budget is the specific budget that deals with infrastructure, it deals with building schools, and we were hanging without one.
And we're still hanging. They were not able to come to an agreement on this. The state senate decided that they would not move on the capital budget unless it also included a reversal of the Hearst decision in toto without any discussion, you know, no plan whatsoever. It's our way or you don't get a budget at all. And
even though we've talked about the Hearst decision many times, that is the decision that affects water wells and water well rights that particularly impacts Whatcom County.
Right. And, well,
our
name is on the suit that made this happen.
Yes.
So we are forever famous for that. But yes, it affects people's ability to dig wells in an exempt way, meaning that they don't have to show, hey, there's enough water for me to dig a well here. I am in accordance with state water laws. They can just do it. And now they can't. And that's a problem. So, we don't have a capital budget, which, and the capital budget, again, funds primarily building projects, rebuilding, repair, not roads, that's transportation budget, but, you know, schools and state hospitals and state facilities and other things. There was a great article in the Tacoma News Tribune about this also affects projects like the cleanup for, you know, there's a lot of toxic areas, especially in the South Sound from industrial areas and stretching up into Everett, where the dirt has so much arsenic in it that people can't, like, wear their shoes inside. They have to wipe their feet, wash their hands constantly. There's a pool of money that the state already has to clean up a lot of that that they can't spend because the authorization is in the capital budget. This is holding up a tremendous amount of work that could be doing, and there's still negotiations happening kind of unofficially. The legislature's not in session, and the governor can call them back if they make a deal, but...
Right. And, you know, there's huge impacts for Whatcom and Skagit County as well. I mean, there is $2 million for the triage center that we've talked about on the show, the mental health, behavioral health triage center that the county would like to use in order to reduce incarceration rates. That's held up. Millions and millions of dollars for Whatcom Community College and education improvements. And all of these things are held up, and they're held up because there wasn't this agreement on Hearst. And I'm glad you brought this up, but, you know, the Republicans have been excellent. I got to say, they've been excellent in framing this thing in a particular way, but I would like to frame it in a little different way.
Well,
which
do you want to explain the way that
the Republicans
framed it
like
first?
My way or the highway. Yeah. The Republicans are like, we either have a permanent fix for Hearst in which there is no money allocated and there are no resources allocated. We just rewrite the law and just move on happily ever after on that, versus where the Democrats were at, which is like, we're willing to work with you for a legislative fix, but there has to be some money and there has to be some resources to deal with people that actually have real water rights under water law, to have to deal with. In other words, we're willing to give you guys a little run room on your legislative fix, but you have to give some money back to us. No money back. So the Republicans have been excellent about saying, well, it's all the Democrats' fault. But the Democrats are actually in this kind of negotiable room where they would have said, you know, if you stop pretending that this isn't a big issue on water quantity and water quality and work with us to dedicate some resources to it, we'll work with you on that. And so this idea that, you know, our schools aren't being built because of the Democrats, I just would ask listeners to be a little skeptical about that narrative. There's a more nuanced story there.
Yeah, and you know, to be clear, these senior water rights holders that are set to be negatively impacted if the Republican plan is enacted are Native American tribes. They are businesses. They are farmers. They are the people who actually went to the trouble of getting water use permits.
Yes, they have water rights.
Yeah, and it's their rights that are endangered by this plan. And, you know, there was a really self-serving editorial in the Seattle Times the other day by a state senator talking about how important it is to have divided government in Washington, how well that's working out for us.
Oh, my gosh.
And there is no evidence for that whatsoever. After three overtime sessions and we still don't have a capital budget, there is no argument to be made for this is working well and we should keep doing this.
Well, and not to shake my cane like from the side of the old folks, but there was a time when a more balanced government would have worked when – nationally and in terms of our state, when there was a mutual focus on compromise to get ahead.
Yes.
And I feel like that has changed everywhere.
Yes.
In terms of, and I'm not going to say, I mean, obviously, as we've been talking about, it's pretty evident that it is the Republican side, at least in this issue. I'm not going to say the Democrats are immune to that. But in general, that there is a lack of working together for a positive vision. Even if you see the reasons to have a different vision, even if you have different priorities and different ideas, we don't have that anymore.
Right. And I guess how I would try to put this together is, you know, you get in a room with a bunch of people and you say, is this not a problem? You agree that this A is a problem. You agree that B is a problem. And you over there agree that C is a problem. And we're not going to make a decision that completely benefits A to the detriment of B and C. We're actually going to try to put A, B, and C together and decide what it is that needs to be done. With the Democrats, they know that this is a major impact to rural property owners, people that maybe bought a piece of property as part of a retirement, and their plans are in limbo because of this. They're not heartless to that, but it's like you cannot engage and deliver to that one segment everything without some sort of circumspect response back to other people who are also concerned about water quantity and water quality in Washington and who aren't benefited by this fix.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we're at this point where you can't shame people for not doing their jobs when they go home and say, "Hey, I didn't do my job," and get reelected. You know, we're in
right.
A really difficult point where, you know, our community values are not conducive to getting actual necessary work done.
Right, and believe me, the Republicans are going to make gigantic hay on this next year when when they're running for election. They're going to make gigantic hay on the fact that the Democrats screwed up and screwed over thousands upon thousands of rural property owners. These old people whose retirements were ruined. You know, they're going to make massive. It's going to be their platform in Washington,
right,
moving forward.
Well,
but the story is more nuanced, which is, you know, it takes two sides not to agree.
Right. And it is interesting, Dave, that you pointed out that some of the people who have pre-existing water rights are farmers. And maybe if somebody was going to argue that haymaking statement, that might be a good place to start. You're listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours. That was Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham also here. And we will be back right after this.
Community to Community Development is your local grassroots organization led by women, people of color, and farm workers.
Comunidad a Comunidad es su organización local de base que es liderada por mujeres, personas de color, y campesinos.
If you care about the food that you eat and having a fair and sustainable food system, you should partner with us.
Si le importa la comida que comemos y quiere mejorar el sistema alimentario, debería juntarse con nosotros.
You can call us at 360-738-0893 or you can find us on the Facebook.
Puede comunicarse con nosotros por teléfono 360-738-0893 o encontrarnos en nuestra página de Facebook.
This is Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours with Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. I want to give a quick shout out, as we do every week, because we have a Fergie Love Fest. And I am excited that he wrote an amicus brief, which is a sort of friend of the court letter, standing up specifically about the anti-trans motion that the president made this week. And he joins 18 attorneys general to urge the United States Armed Services Committee to stand with transgender military service members and protect their right to serve. Dave, that is not all our beloved Fergie did this week.
No, and I want to especially point out that right now the Washington State Attorney General's office is involved in a lawsuit against the federal government over the chemical disaster rule that was passed late last year through previous administration. And why that's important is, you know, a couple of years ago in a town called West in Texas, there was an awful factory fire, and a lot of people were killed because first responders didn't know what chemicals were there on site. And this happens with alarming frequency in this country. There are, you know, there are a lot of videos you can see where first responders are pulling up and a magnesium flare goes off and they didn't know that it was there and they would not have been reacting the way they were. And this rule specifically targets these factories and the like, any place that has large quantities of hazardous chemicals, and requires that they coordinate with local first responders to make sure that they know what's on site, they know what the recovery plan is, they know who's recovering, who's responding to what. And this is really important for all of us, especially here where we have industrial sites nearby. And, you know, the administration has illegally pushed this back further than they are statutorily allowed to do so, and, you know, to keep it under review. But this is very important, and it's really important that people are aware that this is happening, and I think support our Attorney General in this suit.
Yeah, and all I would say is two words: Tesoro Refinery, because that's another case where this particular
Remind us.
There was a fire at the Tesoro Refinery in Anacortes. Seven people lost their lives. This they were fined. They were found to be sort of negligent and indifferent to some of the safety issues. This law would address that. And so it's not just Texas, and actually it happens very close to home. We have some very volatile industries in Whatcom and Skagit counties, and this particular law would assist with the safety of these operations.
Go Ferg. Our Fergie Love Fest continues, and we love our Attorney General. He also, just very briefly, filed a friend of the court brief to the Washington State Supreme Court, arguing that piece rate workers deserve compensation other than picking, and this helps our agricultural workers, and so he's standing up for them in the state also. So, bound chicka bound bound, that is our Fergie Fest. And speaking of going from going from Fergie to our other beloved person that we want to talk about this week, Joe Tihan. Joe Tihan had been at the Joe Show until this week. It was his final day. Joe Tihan before was started with K-Bay, but even before K-Bay, he was a progressive voice on our mainstream media, KGMI, and K-Bay is changing from progressive talk to a music format, meaning that Joe Tihan does not have a show anymore as of this week. Before there was Cascadia News Now, before there was Makeshift's radio station, before there was any other progressive radio, Joe Tihan has been a voice of reason in Bellingham.
Yeah, he really has, and it's a tragedy. You know, Joe is a great gentleman and did not want to say anything about this particular decision. And what can you say? Because it's not a local decision. It was a corporate decision to move. Just to get a little background on this, years ago, KGMI went to a kind of a very hard right talk show format where they had Rush Limbaugh on and they had a number of conservative
Brett Bonner.
Yeah, conservative talk radio. And in a gesture of fairness, you know, the sister station moved and did some progressive radio and some local talk, and it was a nice little mix because, you know, if you got tired of listening to one, you could switch over and talk to the other. They made a corporate decision that they're going to move to, you know, I guess just pop rock station. That's a decision that they made. Joe's a gentleman. He had nothing but. He had actually nothing. He had nothing to say about the decision other than some regret that, you know, the show's coming to a close. I've been a guest on the show many times. Joe's a great gentleman. He knew how to balance and keep opinions in check and be amusing and engaging. His very engaging personality. We're going to miss him a lot. And I guess what I would say is I don't understand these kinds of decisions because there are pop radio stations everywhere. And this was kind of unique. And it had a unique thing for local listeners, progressive radio. It had Joe in particular talking about local issues. We're going to miss it a lot.
Yeah, and I just basically want to repeat everything that Tim said, but in my voice.
Go ahead and do it.
Joe was really excellent. He was personally excellent, and he was a great, you know, person to talk to. I only got to talk to him in person a couple of times, but I love that. I loved his show. And it's really amazing to me, like you were saying, Tim, that they can't make local media work. We're living in a time where people are more aware and in touch with what's going on around them than ever. And we're seeing, you know, big conglomerates like what happened with Joe and on the national level on things like Sinclair and things like that. Pushing towards this more generic, repetitive, you know, there might be six of this station in this market anyway. Well, here's number seven. It really does have a tremendous cost for us as a community. And I hope that we hear more from Joe in the future.
Well, and I want to point out that one of the things that happened with K-Bay is that it kind of took more importance and prominence when the National Air America went off the air. And Air America was Al Franken's sort of vehicle, wasn't it, originally? Mm-hmm. And it was the very first in a sea of Rush Limbaughs, in a sea of Michael Medveds and conservative talk show hosts that was a progressive voice that did not have any representatives. Where Rachel Maddow came from was where Stephanie Miller came from. When Air America went off, they couldn't make it. And at least K-Bay kind of took up the slack. And I do want to jump in also and say with Tim, I was on his show as well. And I mean, not only is he just the gentlest person, but super strong. And unlike our show, he took live calls. And he took live calls from all over the place and a lot of people who disagreed with him and his guests. And he handles them with aplomb. And also, very supportive of community media. And I worked with KVWV when they were getting off the ground. He had us on a show, and he was on the first Hour of the Wolf show that we ever did with Rosalinda Guillen, talking about the importance of community radio. So unlike the powers that be, the commercial radio masters, he saw the value in bringing more voices
right.
to the air.
And he was a hero, and he was very charming. But, you know, a couple of things. One is somebody, I was talking to somebody today, and they said, you know, now all we have is Amy Goodman, but Amy Goodman's not fun to listen to. I mean, some of these talk show guys were very entertaining, and they made you laugh, mm-hmm. and so you had this. But also, you know, there's this unfortunate thing. A long-distance trucker said that, you know, when he's traveling across the country, he hears Rush Limbaugh in this time zone, and then he hears the same show in another time zone. And it's like it's only fun maybe the first three times you hear it, but then now that you're hearing the show broadcast in this different time zone, and so in the Great Basin of the United States, there's only one voice, mm-hmm. and that voice is Rush Limbaugh, because everything else, it's a radio desert.
It's conglomeration is what it is.
Yeah. And whether I'm not, that's not even a judgment about Rush Limbaugh, but it's a radio. When all you get is a particular thing, you're impoverished.
Yeah. And it's less about Rush Limbaugh, but more about the companies that run those stations. It's finding the low water mark. It's what is the best return for the least investment. And we can work locally, we can build people up, we can, you know, put our community's local voice on the air, or not, or we can just play what we, you know, buy from here. And it's sad, it's deeply sad that this is happening, regardless of the politics of anyone.
Why? Absolutely.
Three cheers for Joe.
And I want to say that of course, as we become more a conglomerate world in terms of mainstream media, I have to say, of course, stations like KMRE and community radio, community voices are even more crucial. And we don't make money. We don't have a living, and we need support. So please consider making a donation at KMRE. And not only that, please consider being a citizen journalist yourself. We want your voice. We don't want to just hear our stupid voices talking all the time. So come do a show here, or come be on our show, and we cannot fill the gap that is left by the Joe Show, but we can't let there be silence either. So best of love to Joe. I know we're not done hearing from you. And we're going to go out tonight, CascadiaNewsNow.com, with some music from Alexi Murdoch in honor of the haze over the Puget Sound. We're going to be listening to Orange Sky. This has been Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 Deming Van Zandt and KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham.
Well, I had a dream. I stood beneath an orange sky. Yes, I had a dream. I stood beneath an orange sky, with my brother standing by. With my brother standing by. I said, brother, you know it's a long road we've been working on. Yes, it is, yes, it is, you know. Brother, it is. Such a long road we've been working on. Oh, brother, oh, brother. I had a dream. I stood beneath an orange sky, with my sister standing by. with my sister standing by. Said, here is what I know now, sister. Here is what I know now goes like this. In your love, my salvation lies. In your love, my salvation lies. In your love.